Thank you. Do I look all right? My name is Keith Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, you all really do dress up well. I'm not kidding you. You really look good. I'm just really grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. And I've heard so much about this conference. My sponsor spoke here the year after he agreed to become my sponsor, and I remember him talking about it and how very much he enjoyed being here, and I mentioned it several times. And I'm really grateful to be here. I just can't thank the committee enough for honoring me. I've never met a committee like this one. I don't speak a lot. I a few times a year, maybe a little more sometimes, but I can't do that because I've got to spend the majority of my weekends with the people I sponsor, with people who help me, and doing the normal things because I'm not wrapped too tight, and it'd be real easy for me to end up in left field before I knew that the count was 3-2. A friend of mine, Dick C., told me one time, he said, "You know, Keith, I love you." He said, "But the truth is you haven't seen the ball since the kickoff." And that pretty aptly describes my condition. But I must tell you that I've never seen a committee like this. This committee, and not only the food and the arrangements and everything, but this committee sent clear to Atlanta, Georgia, to bring two people in that I could beat on a golf course. They were looking for a third, but they only had 6 months. They found two, and I just can't tell you how much I appreciate it. It really was a nice day. You know, we went over and played the course at the University of the South in Suwanee, which is just a few miles down the road, and I was really quite taken with being there because the first man that I was privileged to sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous graduated from Suwanee, his name was Alan, and Alan now lives in Washington, D.C., and I spent a lot of time today thinking about him because I know Alan was all over that campus for 4 years. It's changed quite a bit. They have girls there now. I remember part of his story was how they used to transport girls in, you know, up the mountain pass for homecomings and things like that, based on Alan's story, he was on his very best drunken behavior during these times. But it really meant a lot to me to be over there because Alan has meant a lot to me. It's reminded me of what a privilege it is to be able to work with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I wanted to be sure I did it right. I was sober about a year and a half when Alan asked me to sponsor him, and I asked him why, and he said, "'Cause you're so calm." And I knew he was a sicko. And because I used to go about 20 miles a day, and my insides did 35 miles a day. And I was anything but calm. But I guess compared to him, I was. And I remember, I've been a member of Al-Anon for about 9 years, and I love what Virginia said, that if you go to meetings and work the steps, you're a member of Al-Anon, and I'm privileged to do that. But I really needed Al-Anon from my first breath, and I really needed Al-Anon when it came to sponsoring in the beginning, because I thought that I had to have an answer for all of his problems. And I remember I was diligent as I could be. Every time he had a problem, I found an answer, even if I made it up. I found it. And I gave it to him, and I sponsored him for about 6 months, and his first year came up, his first anniversary, and he celebrated at a meeting in Washington, D.C. called Midtown, which is a very nice meeting, and I was there, and in the D.C. area, if it's your anniversary or birthday, you pick the speaker. So he picked me, and he picked somebody else, and when he introduced me, he said, "Now, I got to tell you, this is a guy..." Right, I've spent hours with this man, just healing him. And he said to me, he said, "The thing I like most about my sponsor," and I sit right on the front row, right where Debbie is now, and I He said, the thing I like most about my sponsor is all he ever told me was don't drink and go to meetings. And I said, that isn't all I ever told you. You know? But by the grace of God, all he ever heard was don't drink and go to meetings. You know? So I spent a lot of today thinking about Alan and just how very much I love him and how much I miss him, because I left the D.C. area about 6 years ago, and I know he's doing well. And I'm glad I finally got to go to his alma mater. I just love to golf. I mean, next to not drinking, I think golfing is one of my favorite things. And I'm reminded of a joke that I get to tell when I get to talk. It was about a man and a woman, and the man was sitting at his desk doing his income taxes, and his wife came out of the kitchen, and she was drying some plates and said, honey, and any of you who are married could really understand this. She said, honey, if I died, do you think you'd remarry? He stopped for a minute, and he said, well, I suppose I would. He said, I'm 40 years old. He said, that's still pretty young, and I like companionship, and I don't want to grow old by myself. So, yeah, I imagine I'd remarry. And she went back in the kitchen. She came back a minute later and said, if you remarried, you think you'd live in his house? And he said, well, I suppose so. He said, you know, it's a nice house. He said, you know, 6% loan. He said, you can't get a 6% loan anymore. He said, I suppose we'd live here. And she said, would you sleep in our room? And he said, well, it's the largest room, and it has the bath, adjoining bath and everything. I imagine we'd sleep there. She said, well, would you let her have my jewelry? And he said, well, if you wanted somebody else to have it, they could have it. But if you didn't care or you didn't designate it, yeah, I suppose so. He said, would you let her drive my car? And he said, well, it's paid off, and it's very good on mileage and everything. And she was really getting upset, and finally she said, would you let her use my golf clubs? And he said, no. And she said, you mean you'd marry her? You'd bring her into my house? You'd sleep with her in my bed? You'd let her wear my jewels and drive my car? Why wouldn't you let her use my golf clubs? And he said, she's left-handed. When Virginia and Debbie were talking, Debbie last night and Virginia this morning, I was really moved, and I want to thank you both very much. You've really contributed greatly to my weekend, and I really do want to thank you. I was touched by both of you. You're a real black belt Al-Anon, I got to tell you. I love that. I was reminded of this AA and Al-Anon who were walking down a street in Miami, and they went by a travel agent, and it had a sign in the window that said, Aruba, round trip, $98. And the AA said, that's a heck of a deal, $98 round trip. He said, let's go. So they went inside, and they went up to the agent and said, we're interested in that $98 round trip to Aruba. And the guy said, well, then step in that back room back there. Well, they stepped in this. It was a real little room. It was dark. And the floor gave way, and they slid down into this basement. And some people grabbed him and stuck him in the arms with needles. And they passed out. And about 2 days later, they came to, and they're side by side on this oar. And there's a guy there cracking a whip, and another guy beating on a drum, and they're rowing this big boat. And the AA looked over at the Al-Anon and said, this is awful. And the Al-Anon said, it sure is. And the AA said, God, I hope they'll fly us back. And the Al-Anon said, they didn't last year. Now we know why I go to meetings, huh? I really am privileged to be here, and I'm really impressed with the amount of not drinking that goes on with the people in this place. It is amazing to me. I was talking with Debbie incidentally, Harold kept referring to him not as the voice of the conference, but as the mouth of the conference, okay? But when you were talking about upgrading the mailing list, I said to Debbie, they could take a lot of us off. And that's how I've always felt about myself. But now it's a joke, because You know, as a result of being sober in this program, I really do deserve to be at the very finest places. And there isn't a finer place in the world than with you. And I'm privileged to be here. You know, I when we get up here, and besides tell bad jokes and ramble on and laugh, but we're supposed to tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to attempt to do that. I grew up in a family with 10 brothers and sisters. We were Irish, and I won't tell you what church we went to. You'll have to guess. But I was the second oldest child and the oldest son in this family. And we're extremely wealthy, very, very wealthy, as I look at it now. Now, we had a real cash flow problem. But we were extremely wealthy. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I had parents who were just incredible love machines. I know with 11 children it would appear that way, but they really were. They just loved. I mean, it was amazing to me. They did strange things, things I never saw until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. They did things like think of you first. And my mother, who was raised in an alcoholic home and with the terror of an alcoholic home, her father died when she was quite young, and then her mother was a periodic alcoholic, and she lived with that terror and survived that terror and emerged a great lover of knowledge and of books and things, and she transmitted that to us. By the time I went to high school, I'd read all the classics, and we didn't have a TV or anything because of the cash flow problem. So we used to take different parts in plays and have our own Shakespearean theater, have discussions, and we practiced democracy, and my father was a veto power. But we prayed together. We did things that are incredible. And the reason I say this is because I grew up knowing I had a bad deal. And it wasn't until I was sober about 6 years and went to work a ninth step with a former boss of mine who happened to be a priest, when he said to me, he said, "Keith, I believe you lived because of the incredible spiritual training you had as a child." And the light bulb went on. And that's precisely what I had, because I learned all about love. And, you know, the clothes weren't always new and the food wasn't always plentiful or there. But I grew up in incredible wealth, just incredible wealth. And I want to thank my parents for that. But you know, I didn't know that when I was a little kid. When I was a little kid, I was just scared. We used to go to bed kind of early because there was no TV or anything. And everybody else, all my brothers and sisters, would go off to sleep. And I'd just lay there till 3, 4 in the morning, just practicing terror. I'd just lay there and think of all the things there were to be afraid of. And first and foremost was a thing that lived under my bed. I don't know if anybody had anything under their bed, but I had something that lived under my bed. And if you'd lay there with your ear against the mattress, you could hear it moving. And it didn't move when the lights were on. It only moved when the lights were out. And I'd lay there, and I'd hear this thing scratching around under the bed. Now, I didn't know what it would do if it got a hold of me, because it must have been horrible, because I never talked to anybody who had ever survived. And so what I'd do at night is I'd lay there and I'd lay sideways and I'd concentrate on being real small, because this thing used to reach up from under the bed. And in the morning, if you look, there are marks it would leave on the sheets, you know, where it reached up and it was scratching for you. And in the daytime, it lived in a closet. That isn't unusual. What's unusual is that I never told anybody about it. Because I was not only afraid, I was ashamed of being afraid. I remember one night, the thing was under the bed. It was particularly active that night, and I figured it was probably real hungry. And I was laying there being real small, just concentrating on being real small, and my bladder was telling me it was time to get out of bed and go do something. And I remember the big decisions that I had to make as a five-year-old. Do I wet the bed and put up with that grief? Or do I take a chance on it getting me? So what I did was I got up and I ran and I leaped as far as I could out into the black void and I hit the floor and both my parents came out of bed and said, "My God, what's going on up there?" And you know, I'd rather face their being angry with me than tell them the truth about me. And it's always been the way it was with me. It was like you all knew what was going on. I kind of imagined that one time God said, "All right, everybody get in here." And he got everybody in a room. And he said, "I'm going to go through it once. And I'll entertain questions." And he told everybody about what it was like to grow up, what it was like to be a real man, what women were like. And he went through the whole thing. And I was in the bathroom. I was the only one who wasn't privy to the whole picture. And I thought you all knew. And I didn't. So my job was to act like I knew what was going on. You know, it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out you didn't know either. And it was a great relief to know you didn't know. But this is the way I grew up. And I remember my first drink. My first drink took place when I was 5 years old and my brother Denny was four. I don't often talk about Denny because he's a bit of an embarrassment, but I can share with you. Denny was... as we go on, I'll tell you about him. But my father decided it'd be kind of cute if we had a beer. And my mother was out, probably going to bingo or something. And we were sitting around a table. And my father got a beer for each of us. And then he gave us little glasses. Remember the jelly glasses that had the cartoon characters on it? Well, mine had Superman on, which would psychologists have a good time with now. But I remember we drank our beer. And I thought it was kind of nice. And I was feeling all right, but I looked across the table, and my brother Denny was sliding down off the chair, and he was giggling and things. And my father got a little shook up and told us that we're going to go right to bed, and he put our little jammies on us with the feet and the trap door and everything. And he said, "I want you to go right to bed. Don't say anything to your mother." Well, I was a nice kid. I was willing to go along, but Denny wasn't hearing it. He's singing, "Mary had a little lamb," and he was staggering around, and he trying to dive over the banister and things. And so my father picked him up, and we went upstairs, and he put us in bed. And he said, "Now, not a word, please, and go right to bed. Don't tell your mother. If you go right to sleep, I'll take you to a movie Saturday." I thought, well, that's a good deal. But Denny wasn't hearing it, you know. And all of a sudden, Denny stood up. It was disgusting. I was fortunately on the other side of the room. But Denny stood up, and he urinated all over the floor. And I remember laying there watching this disgusting display. And I was thinking, I don't know the exact words, but my thinking was something like, you know, now there's a little kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And I'm going to tell you that it was awful. It was awful because, you know, he grew up to become a social drinker. That's the most disgusting thing I ever heard of. I mean, a kid with potential like that. He was 4 years old, and he was already there. Yeah? But it's sort of like, and I was all right, and I had to work to get there, you know? But, I mean, he had it all. He had it in the palm of his hand. And he let it slip by. We don't talk much about him in the family, but I want to tell you, this is the kind of guy he was. You know what he did? He grew up. You ready for this? He went to one college. He had one major. He went to one graduate school. For the last 20-some years, he's worked for one company. And the most disgusting thing of all is he's been married to one woman. It's enough to make you want to cry, you know? Well, I held up the family tradition. I didn't let all that terrible stuff happen to me. He's really a great guy. God, I love him. We had the best time together. But he's always scared when we get together for dinner. He travels a fair amount, and I've traveled a fair amount. We'll get together for dinner. He's always afraid when the waiter will say, "Would you like a drink?" He just cringes because I always save them for him, you know. And I say things like, Yeah, give me a case of scotch and a fire axe. You know? And he just chagrined, you know. And I remember one time, it was so embarrassing. We were a very fine restaurant in Washington, D.C., and a waiter came along and said to him, "Would you like a drink?" And I said, "No, thank you." And he looked relieved, you know. And then he said, "No, not on an empty stomach." I jumped up, threw my napkin on a table, and I said, "That's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard in my life. Have a drink, your stomach won't be empty anymore." You know? I don't understand how these people think. You know? But at any rate, you know, I spent most of my young life just sort of being afraid and not measuring up to my own mind and thinking of ways of getting away. And I graduated from high school when I was 17, and that was in May. And by July, or in June, and by July, I had decided that I needed to go to the military. And most of the people I went to school with, I really did get to go to a very fine school, high school, and most of the people I went to school with were college bound. And I knew I could never go to college. I was far too dumb and didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought that had something to do with it. And so what I did was I went into the service. Well, I went into the Marine Corps. So I was 113 pounds, and I was about 5'1" tall. And I went up to Pittsburgh, which is 60 miles from where I grew up. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. I know I talk like I've been down in the South all my life, but I haven't been. And I went up and joined the Marine Corps, and I was terrified. I mean, I was terrified, and I kept looking around at all these people, and I knew they knew the big picture, and I didn't know. And I joined, and there were four of us, and the other three guys were older than I and knew a lot about the world because they were present when God explained everything. So I was just sort of watching them and faking it, you know. And we went off to a bar in Pittsburgh, and I went in that bar, and I was terrified because the bar was filled with big, real men. I mean, real men. You know, I mean, tattoos. You know, they cussed, their teeth were yellow. I mean, real men, you know. And what the hell am I doing here? And they asked me what I wanted to drink. Well, I looked around in a panic, and everybody else was drinking beer, and I said beer. And years later, a psychologist scratched his chin and said to me, "Why did you drink in the first place?" And I remember, that bothered me. I used to buy a fifth of scotch and go down by the stream and drink it and wonder why I drank in the first place. I'd sit in the bar and make little rings on the bar with the bottom of my glass, wondering why I drank in the first place. And I'd sit and look at the mirror behind the bar and make faces and say, "Wonder why I drank in the first place." Well, after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out it was because I was a 5'1", 113-pound, terrified child in a bar with steel workers and coal miners in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I did not have the guts to ask for a sarsaparilla. That's why I drank in the first place. What's important to me is what happened, and I got to tell you what happened. I drank that first beer, and then everybody had another one, so I had that second beer. And then everybody ordered another one, so I had that third beer, and I was midway between that second and third beer, and something happened. I can't explain it, other than the fact that it was a spiritual awakening. And I looked around, and I was transformed in a matter of seconds into something I had never been before. And those of you who have been transformed know what I'm talking about. And I'll never forget it as long as I lived. I stood up, and the floor was way down there. You know? And I looked to my right, and my shoulder was way out there. And I looked to my left, and my shoulder was way out there. And the muscles were busting through my shirt. But that wasn't the big part. The big part was I looked around that room, and a room was filled with snibbling little nothings who didn't know anything about the world, didn't know anything about women, didn't know anything about politics, and I knew it was my job to explain it. So I went around that room the rest of the evening and explain to these poor people exactly how it was. And they were saying, oh, thank you, thank you. We've been waiting for you to come. You're like a Messiah. We've been waiting for you to come for years. Oh, thank you, thank you. Please don't leave. I said, no, I have to go defend our country. And I went and I got on a train. And the next day I woke up and I was in Washington, D.C. And that was three times as far as I'd ever been from home in my life. Once I'd gone to Cleveland, but the game was rained out. And I woke up and it was awful because I looked and I was 5 feet 1 inch tall. I was 113 pounds. And I didn't know anything. But I knew that yesterday I knew. And it was awful. And it was much worse than it had been prior to that. And somebody said, let's have a drink. I said, okay. So he went and had a few beers and it happened again. And then I'm not too thick. I knew what it was. What it meant was that alcohol was a secret ingredient. And alcohol was the thing that made it all work for me. You know, I was the last of a dying breed. I was the last of the thoroughbred alcoholics that came into Alcoholics Anonymous. People say, why didn't you ever get into drugs? Boy, you'd be a fool to get into drugs. I mean, after alcohol, who on earth would want anything else? I mean, alcohol works so good. Who would want drugs? Who would want other drugs? You know, but a lot of people I know, but it never crossed my mind. It never dawned on me that I ever needed anything else. Now, you know, within a few years, that miracle wasn't happening anymore, but I knew it was there. You know, in the beginning, I could get to a certain point, and I could hold it. And I could hold it. And boy, we'd be overseas or something, and I could hold it 2-3 days. And I was magnificent, absolutely magnificent. At the very end of my drinking, I'd be sitting there, somewhere between a second or third, here'd come, he'd go, boom! And it'd be gone. And I remember I'd say, maybe tomorrow it'll stay. You know, maybe tomorrow it would stay. But it never came to stay again. Because, you know, after I got so sick, it wouldn't work anymore. You know, I like places like this because after I got out of the Marine Corps, I spent a couple years in a Jesuit theologiate. That's where the Jesuit priests take their last 4 years of theology training. And they're ordained there. And I worked there in a genetics laboratory. And it was very significant because that's where I drank by myself for the first time. And it was a very significant time for me. I started to college and a number of things. But something happened to me there which was to come back and haunt me. It was in Woodstock, Maryland. And around the old college, they had what they called the mile path. It was a path that people would walk around. And it was a mile. And people would pray and meditate or just spend time with God. And I was walking around there obsessing. You know, remember how it was? It's not fair. It's just not fair. And I was obsessing with how unfair the whole thing was. I don't know what was unfair that day. And a man said to me, a very kind man said to me, he said, oh, son, you're just contemplating the existence of God. And I remember how angry I got. And I said to him, look, buddy, if there's a God, he's in Mexico and doesn't want to get involved in my life. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, please do me a favor. He said, don't do yourself the injustice of being an agnostic. He said, if you choose not to believe in God, fine and go. You know, just go and live what life you have. And he said, if you choose to believe in God, wonderful. Grow in that. He said, but don't do yourself the disservice of not knowing the most important thing that any of us can ever know. And that's our relationship with God as we understand Him. And I know what he said was profound, but it also disagreed with my illness. And I said some very nasty things to him and walked on. The man's name was Murray. He was one of the great theologians of the 20th century, and he was dead before I got sober. But his words weren't, and I read them years later after I went back to school to get a degree in theology. I read them, and what he said proved to be true in my life, that the most important job I have is to recognize my continuing relationship with God as I understand Him and as He manifests Himself to me. But I didn't know that then, because then I was in the process of getting sick. And you know, I got out of the Marine Corps because it was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. So I went to work in a steel mill. And it's hot and dirty, and it's an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. You know? So I went to Baltimore and went to work at this theologate and started at college, and that was an abnormal way to live, and made me drink funny. So I moved to Washington, D.C., and that's really an abnormal way to live. And I suddenly realized that my problem wasn't, you know, where I lived. My problem was the fact that I was single. So I got married. You talk about an abnormal way to live. You know? And I married this young woman who was just asking to get sick. And she wanted an express train, and she got one. We got as sick in 4 years as I think human beings can get. It was really awful. It's unbelievable what happened to us. We had two beautiful children, but let me briefly tell you what happened. I like to tell this for my Al-Anon friends, because I think this epitomizes for me better than anything I've ever heard how alcoholism worked in my unit of love. My wife and I used to start over. I don't know if you've ever started over. But we'd start over, and it's a lot of fun to start over. I mean, it's really nice. You take the kids to one of the grandparents, you know, and then you come back and you start over. And she would go out and buy some really nice, really sexy things, you know, and we'd giggle and everything, and it's going to be a big surprise. And I'd be good. I'd be good. I'd go to work and I'd come home, and we'd have a drink, one drink. And then we might have a little wine with dinner. And then we'd go off to the theater because she loved the theater. Or we just might stay home and dance and make love. And, you know, she'd put one of these things on and we'd make love. It was really something, you know. And then the second day, starting over was going so well, I'd stop at the bar to tell the guys who were anxiously awaiting the outcome of this starting over what would happen. And I'd look, and you know how time flies in a bar. I'd look, it'd be 9 o'clock, I'd say, oh, my God. And I knew the routine. The food is still on the table. You know, she'd clean up everybody's plate but mine. And mine would sit there until the maggots took over, you know. But my plate had to be there when I came in because it was a way of saying, now you see what you've done? And I didn't want that. And so I just figured, well, I'll make sure she's asleep. So I stayed till 2 o'clock and the bar closed. And I went home. And you know, on the way home, I was thinking, Keith, you're really very selfish. This woman went out and bought those frilly things. She's mad about you. She constantly wants your body. And here you are. You're going to deprive her of that. You know, you have no right. You have no right to do that. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. So I was ashamed of myself. So I went home and decided I was going to give in. Well, it's about 2:30, and you ever seen a Al-Anon get up, a 2:30 get up? My wife had one. It was brown, and it started up here. You know. And it'd go to the end of the sleeves, and it'd go clear to the floor, and it was real thick, you know. And it looked like a buffalo robe is what it looked like, you know. And she had that on, and what that meant was not tonight, and maybe not ever, but certainly not tonight. And I went from being as nice as I was going to be to let her have me to really resenting the fact that she was depriving me of my just husband rewards and rights. And so I started telling her about it, and she started telling me about some few things and got very personal. And at this time, she was seeing a psychiatrist, which explained why I drank so much. And because she was having some real problems, and I was willing to stick it out, but this was more than... And she took these pills, which were... funny, the pills made one eye go one way and one eye go the other way. And I decided that I didn't want to hit her, so I ran around and I tore the apartment up. I don't know if you ever did that. I go into a rage and I just start throwing things and carrying on. And she grabbed her matching buffalo robe house coat and put it on, and she grabbed her purse and she went running out into the night with one eye looking this way and one eye looking that way. And she was going, running out in the night. And I don't know what she was going to do. She was going to go call her psychiatrist, who had never heard my side of the story. and the psychiatrist didn't like me, and he was going to say, call the police, and the police were going to come. I knew the routine. So I ran around, and I cleaned that place up. That place looked better than it did before I got home. I vacuumed. I put all the trash in it. I did everything. You know, I ran. I took my clothes off. My mother-in-law had given me a pair of pajamas I wore when the police came, and I got those out of the bottom drawer, and I put those on, and I brushed my teeth, and I messed my hair up, and the doorbell rang. And I went, and I looked out the little peek hole, and there were two county policemen. One of them was an old guy, about 30, and the other guy was a young guy, about 22. And I got myself all prepared. I opened the door, and I said, thank God you found her. And the policeman said, sir, could we come in? And I said, I'm sorry, I'm beside myself with grief. Please, come in. And they came, and they looked around. The place looked good, you know. And my poor wife got that pre-Al-Anon all-no look on her face. And I thought I had it, you know, but you can't be too careful when you're dealing with the police. And I said to her, did you call the doctor? And she said, yes. And I said, well, thank God, if you have to run out of here in the middle of the night, at least you called the doctor. You know, she put her head down and she ran into the bedroom. And I remember the older policeman sort of reached over and hit me on the arm and said, you hang in there, son. And I said, yes, sir. You know? And you know, I went to the refrigerator and I opened it up and I got out a big glass and I put some ice cubes in it and I fixed myself a real tall scotch. And then I got a wine glass and I poured her some of her wine. And I went in and she was sitting on the side of the bed. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. God, please don't let me forget it. The tears were rolling off of her cheeks. And you know, when people are hurt as deeply as people get hurt, as we get hurt and people around us get hurt, the tears are huge, huge tears. And I'll never forget them. They came off her cheek under her buffalo robe. And she looked up at me. And she's a beautiful person. And she looked up at me and said, can you ever forgive me for embarrassing you like that? And I said to her, honey, you didn't mean to do it. You're having a hard time. And I understand. And she said, what would I do without you? And she said, don't ever leave me. And I said, I promise I won't. And she drank her wine and took another one of those pills. And I drank my scotch. And she took the buffalo robe off and put on one of those frilly little things. And we made love. And folks, we thought we were normal. And that's what it was like living in my family. And we loved one another. We loved one another the best way we knew how. We were just so terribly sick. We were so locked away from the rest of the world. I had people who loved me. She had people who loved her. We were so horribly locked away from the rest of the world that nobody could bring the love into us. God couldn't get in. Nobody could get in. The horrible way of living. You know, we would get together with four or five other young couples. Not what you're thinking. We're all from the Midwest. But we would have a discussion group, and what we'd do is somebody would say, let's read such and such a book. So we'd all read the book, and we'd all get together and have drinks and snacks and discuss the book. Or we'd all go to the theater, or we'd all take in a movie, and we'd discuss it. And one time we read a book called Open Marriage, which was a thing that took place in the 60s, which was they tried to sophisticate spouse swapping. And everybody said, oh, boy, that's not for me. It might be for some people. It was not for me. I didn't respond that way. I rose from my chair and went into this 20-minute tirade about the fact that the fabric of the nation was being pulled apart. I went on for 20 minutes, and people kept saying, boy, you really feel strongly about this. But, you know, some people may want to do it, but it's not for us. Nobody. And I went on and on for 20 minutes. It was unbelievable. And a week later, I was in the middle of an affair. And that's what being an alcoholic was like for me. I thought that if I could believe something hard enough, I wouldn't have to do it. I chose as my majors in college philosophy, majoring in ethics, and moral theology, because I thought if I could learn enough about what was right, I wouldn't always do what was wrong. And when I looked at my life, I became less the person I wanted to be than I'd been the day before. That's alcoholism. I became less the kind of husband, less the kind of father, less the kind of employer, less the kind of supervisor, less the kind of child of God than I was the day before. That's the horror of this disease for me, was that there was less and less and less. And then, you know, one day it just ran out, and my wife looked at me, and we just can't go on like this. For the sake of the children, you have to leave. And I remember how grateful I was. And I left, and I went, and I lived in a little place in the ghetto of Washington, D.C., and it was a little one-room place. It was subterranean. It was so dark in there, even mold wouldn't grow. And it really fit the way I felt, and it fit the way I felt about myself. And I began to then drink on the streets, 14th Street of Washington, D.C. And I don't know if you noticed, I ain't the right color to be drinking on the 14th Street in Washington, D.C. And I used to go to the bootleg joints there, and they're all in a basement. And I remember one night I stood up and made a particularly racist remark, and I was about, at this point, about 180 pounds. I couldn't get near any open flames. I'd burst into flames. And this guy grabbed me, this big black guy grabbed me, and he put a .45 right in my mouth. I can still taste the oil, you know. And he said, "I'd kill you, you honky, but I don't want to do you no favors." And he threw me out of this bootleg joint. And what they do is they throw you up the steps in bootleg joints. It's real hard on the nose and things, you know. And I remember walking home saying, that's what I wanted him to do. I wanted him to do what I can't do. And then I began to drink in a zoo. I don't know if we have any zoo drinkers here. I always ask wherever I go, any zoo drinkers? I don't want to talk anybody into drinking, but if you should ever return to drinking, I hope you don't, I would strongly recommend a zoo. I'll tell you why, because you're going to end up there anyway. You know, what you do is what I did. I can just share my experience, strength, and hope. And what I did was I got one of these large Tupperware glasses, 20 ounces, right? And I got a pink one because scotch looked like iced tea. And I'd fill it all the way up, and then I put one ice cube in it so I wouldn't be an alcoholic. Then I put the top on it, and I'd burp it just like they say at the Tupperware parties. Then I would go down to the National Zoo. And I'd go in, and you can choose a lot of places. I've talked with people who drank in the lion house and people who drank around the snakes and everything. I am a primate man myself. I really like the gorilla cages. So I'd go into the gorilla cage, and they had bleachers in there, and I'd go clear to the far back, because I never wanted to be up front. I never wanted a lot of attention. I just want to sit back there, mind my own business, and drink. And watch these idiots come in and out with their families and the people who didn't understand the big picture. And I remember I sat there, and you know, you go in a place for a while, you get to know everybody, and directly across from where I sat was this orangutan. And orangutans are nicer than all the other apes. They have a lot more personality and things. And after a while, we sort of had some eye contact going. And I'd go in there, and this orangutan would jump up and down and be kind of happy. And you know, that was a new thing in my life. And I'd wave, and the orangutan would wave. And we got to the point where we used to point at the people and laugh. And somebody asked me once if the orangutan was male or female. I don't know. It didn't matter. I was impotent by this time. But one day, that orangutan looked at me in what I perceived to be utter disgust and turned around and shuffled out the back of the cage to the outside area. And I was crushed. And I stood up and I began to share my feelings with that orangutan. And a keeper came over and threw me out. And I said, I'll never be back. And I haven't been. And I kind of considered that the end of my social drinking, because then I went home and I drank completely alone. And, you know, one day I just wanted to die. I just wanted to die. And that was the last day I had to drink. That was the day that I decided I was going to commit suicide, and I went into my bathroom, and I had been around a lot of hospitals working in them, and a lot of my friends were physicians, and they noticed my nervous condition, so they gave me a lot of pills, and I never took them, so I saved them all. So I had hundreds of pills in my medicine cabinet, and I either began to take them or was going to begin to take them. I can't remember. It was after a week binge. And something happened, and all of a sudden, I knew that I couldn't die. And I was 29 years old, and I knew that you're not supposed to take your life when you're 29 years old, that somehow life's supposed to sort of be beginning for you at that time. And I had two phone numbers, and I'd lost one of them, and the phone number I still had was to a treatment center. The other was to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took me 2 years of sobriety to recognize the fact that my ex-wife had given me those numbers and said, if you ever want to help yourself, they may be able to help you. And I didn't want to give her that much credit. But I called that number, and they said, if you don't drink, it's Monday, if you don't drink between now and Wednesday, we'll take you. And I remember I just sat down on the floor and I began to sob. And I mean really sob and sob. And I looked up, and it was a fifth of scotch on a draining board. And I was given what I believe my God gave me as a very special gift. And I think everybody who comes to AA and Al-Anon comes with one very special gift. And it's fun to look for it. But my gift was the first step, because I knew that if I took one drink, I was going to die. And I know that knowing that would not keep me from taking it. So I ran over and I began to pour this bottle out. And I knew that I'd never pour it out. And I knew that if I took one drink, I'd die, and knowing it wouldn't keep me from taking it. What I knew was I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. And by powerless, I meant I'd drink it. And I believe that today. I believe that there's a drink out there with my name on it today. I've got a disease that necessitates I take it. But what I've got is a recovery program that can keep it away from me. I threw that bottle and it broke, and I think if it had bounced, I might not be here tonight. But I had a God who loved me even when I defied him, or even when I denied his existence. And I got out to that treatment center, and it took me hours to drive out there. A couple years later, I worked there, and I'd get there in 45 minutes. But that day, it took me hours because the terror would come in, and I'd cry, and I wet my pants, and I was changing my pants beside the road on Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out on the ground, and I wondered what the hell had gone wrong. What was wrong? And I got out there, and they told me that what was wrong was that I had a disease called alcoholism. It was a spiritual dilemma. And that I needed to go to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous if I wanted to live. And that night I went off to my first AA meeting. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. The room was filled with people who were all 10 days older than dirt. They were the oldest people I ever saw in one gathering in my life. And I'm thinking, oh no. And the one man welcomed everybody at the door. And he had these deep eyes. You know the kind of eyes that are real deep, that go clear into the soul, like Virginia talked about this morning? And he looked me dead in the eye, which I thought was a pretty obnoxious way to treat a newcomer. And he said to me, son, you never have to drink again. And I began to cry, because I thought that was kind of pushy and personal. How did he know I had a drinking problem? Yeah. And then I went in and I sat next to this old lady who was a patter. She got me a half a cup of coffee and she patted me for half an hour. You ever been near a patter? Your skin's crawling around and she's patting you. And I was ready to scream. And halfway through the meeting in the Washington area, they take the collection. And she looked at me and she smiled and she looked deep inside of me too. And she said, honey, you never have to be alone again. And you know, I thought about the little kid laying in the middle of the bed trying to be small. I thought about the guy who used to take walks around the bar, not wanting to drink because he wanted to go home and hold his wife in his arms and be something to her. But he didn't know how, and he didn't know how to ask. And I thought about the guy who wanted to be a father and didn't want to leave his infant daughter in a crib to run to the liquor store and then drink out of guilt because he had read a lot about crib death and things. I wanted to be all those things, and I didn't want to be alone. And I thought that he didn't understand, and she didn't understand the condition that I had, that my condition was different. But I tell you, I fell in love with you. There's no other way to describe it. I just fell in love with you. You were everything I ever wanted to be when I grew up. And it wouldn't work for me, and I was different than you. But I wanted to be around you as long as I could be. It was like I was a moth, and I was flying toward a flame. And you know, I knew eventually I was going to die, and I was going to not be anymore. But boy, it feels so good for a while. And that's the way it was with you. And I watched you. I'd always been a people watcher, and I watched you. And I watched you do strange things. I watched guys who were real important guys, admirals and senators and congressmen, argue over who was going to get to make coffee this month. I did. I watched people who were 20 years without a drink argue over who was going to get to go on the next 12-step call. And I just watched you. I just watched you give. And one night I had a man who had agreed to be my sponsor. His name was Dan. I don't know where Dan is now. God, I hope he's alive. But he sort of drifted away after a few years. But the man taught me how to live like a sober human being. I watched him one night, and he used to make me report every night up to Connecticut Avenue where you answer the phones. And I wasn't allowed to answer the phones, but I was allowed to say, "Hold, please," which is pretty good for a new guy. I'd say, "Hold, please," and I said, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous, hold, please," and I put him on hold, and then when Dan was ready, he'd talk to him, and when he finished with the other call. And I saw him one night talk to a woman who was drunk and asking him to come to her apartment. And I heard him saying things like, "No, ma'am, we don't do it that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll give your name or telephone number to a woman, and a couple women will come by and talk to you." And I was thinking, you know, this woman will never know who he is, and he's doing these nice things. And I was struck by that. And I began to cry. I cry at supermarket openings, but things like this really moved me. And I began to cry, and I said, after he hung up, I said, "Dan, you people are so wonderful. You're so loving. You're so good." And he looked at me and grinned, and he said, "Well, then you are too, my friend, because you're one of us." And I began to learn that there were ways about me, there were ways about you. And I pursued you, and I was afraid to believe it all. But I learned to believe little bits and pieces of it. You know, one of the things I believed was that I had to have an answer for every problem. I told you how I treated my friend Alan. Well, I used to think that if you had a problem, you had to get an answer. If you didn't get an answer, you'd drink. I don't know why I thought that. I just thought that. And so one time I had a problem. It was a terrible problem. I can't remember what it was now. It was terrible. And I went to an old guy who always gave me answers. And he said, "I don't have the answer to that problem." I said, "Oh, no." And he said, "But there's a man in downtown D.C. who has the answer. Here's his name. Go look him up." So I went down the club, and I found this guy. And I said, "I got this problem." He said, "Not now. We're going to have a meeting." I said, "You don't understand." I said, "I only got about an hour to get an answer to this thing." He said, "Take it easy. Take it easy." So we had a meeting, and we went aside and had some coffee. And by this time, I'm desperate. And I said to him, I said, "Here's my problem." And I told him. And he shook his head, and I'll never forget. He's a black guy and had real white hair. And he looked at me, and his eyes were real sad. And he said, "Son," he said, "I don't know the answer to that." And I said, "Oh, no." He said, "But all I can tell you is don't drink even if your ass falls off." I remember I was driving home and I was saying, "That's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life." And you know, that's the day I discovered that this isn't about answers. This is about solutions. And you know, you're the solution to my problem. My first solution is don't drink. Go to meetings. But you're the solution to my problem. And then, you know, you and the big book got me ready to read the big book. And there I found some wonderful answers for me. It's just magnificent. And now, I want to tell you, after a number of years, I was sitting on a balcony in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And you know, when I was in a treatment center, I called that poor woman that had been so abused at the hands of my disease. and told her, I said, honey, I'm an alcoholic. And she said, no shit. And I said, but why me? And she said, why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do. She hung up the phone. Well, I fouled that away. And one day I was sitting on this balcony in Fayetteville, North Carolina, looking at this lake. And I'd just been with a group of people like you at a meeting. And I was reading about a very special thing that had taken place a couple thousand years ago that's very profound in my life. I began to cry. And I said, why me, Father? Why have you picked me to give these things to? This sobriety, these people, your son. Why me? And I heard him say to me, why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous for me. It's not just having it. It's being a child of God and deserving it. And that's very, very different. Because I always lived on a planet I didn't belong on. And I always lived in a place where somebody was going to come and tell me to move. But you know, now it's my place, and it's my planet, and it's my God, and you are my friends, and you're my family. You know, if I don't drink a day at a time in about a week, I'll have 12 years of magnificence to this program. And I want to tell you before I leave that the impotence was a real problem. I want to show you how AA works. I was 29 years old and impotent. And it took me 3 months to finally tell somebody. You got to be careful when you talk about delicate things like this. You want to stay away from the old-timers. Old-timers are funny in the head. You know, they too much coffee, you know, too much cigarette smoke, and they're funny in the head, you know. So I went to this old-timer, and he laughed. I don't know what he did with his own impotence, but he laughed at mine. And he said, don't worry, son. He said, that'll go away. And I said, how long? He said, a couple years. I said, a couple years? You don't understand. I said, and he said, oh, calm down. So what I did was I went to my sponsor. And sponsors are magnificent because what my sponsor said to me was, Keith, you have a lot of problems, don't you? I said, boy, do I have a lot of problems. I said, I got a lot of problems. I said, I got all of them. He said, I know you do. He said, you got them worse than anybody I've ever seen. I said, I know. And he said, of all the problems you have, which one is going to be more fun to work on than this one? You know, I said, you know, I can't think of a problem it's going to be more fun to work on in this one. And, you know, that's what sponsors do. They take tragedy and put a smile on it. You know, I mean, I went from being in absolute despair over impotence to just gnawing at the bit to get started on this thing, you know. And I want to share with you, this program works. I really am delighted to have spent time with you. There's so much I'd like to tell you about God as I understand Him and about you as I understand Him. You know, there was a French philosopher named Pascal who said something that reminded me of what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous for some time. He said, God created man in His own image, and unfortunately, man returned to favor. And you know, for some years around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I created God in my image. And I had done that drunk, too. And my image was petty and small and punishing and angry. And the kind of God that thought you were going to get close and then He pulled the rug out from under you. I wouldn't let people know I liked Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was afraid God would find out and take it away from me. That's the kind of God I created. And what I finally did was I got on my knees in a place in Texas and said, God, I'll take you any way you come. I'll take you any way you come. And I'm not going to have any opinions about you. I'm just going to take you the way you come. Please come. And like that, He was there. And that's the magnificence of Alcoholics Anonymous. And He's here. and I love you, and I love him, and he loves us. And you know, if anybody deserves it, we do. Thank you very much.